Morning. Kids, ages 9 to 10, maybe 11, it's good to have you in the room. We're going to be talking about some intense things, but I think I was talking about with my kids earlier this week, and they found it somewhat interesting. So hopefully you guys can also catch on to some of this stuff too. When we started this sermon series, the first sermon that I preached, I used an example that I thought, oh, I wish the kids were in the room for this example. So maybe I'm going to go back to it. We talked about the pass the parcel game. Do you know that game, the pass the parcel game? Where you have like a gift all wrapped up, in usually newspaper, and you pass it around the circle, and you, when the music goes off, you have to stop, and whoever has it gets to unwrap the first layer, and then whatever gift is in there, that's yours, right? And then you keep doing that until everybody in the circle has a gift. So what I was saying is, in our house, we try to make every single layer the same kind of gift, so nobody feels like they got a bad layer. So everybody gets the same thing. Nobody feels jealous. And what I said was, when we're talking about the cross and Jesus dying on the cross, sometimes we're like, what? What's the cross about? What happened on the cross? And it's a little bit like a pass the parcel game, where every week there's a new layer. There's a new thing to understand. And one of the kids I was talking to this week said, it's like every layer gets you deeper and deeper into what it means. So we've been doing that the past few weeks, thinking about what the cross means, that it means a lot of things. It doesn't mean everything, but it means a lot of different things. And when we search the scriptures, the Bible, we actually find the cross is really rich with meaning. There are so many ways of thinking about it. Let me pull back from the cross, though. I'm just going to talk about death for a second, just as a general thing. Not just Jesus' death. Do you know there's a thing called being a death doula? Somebody who helps people walk through death. And our staff had a death doula come and speak with us a little while back. And one of the things that she was teaching us was that death is not just about the moment that someone dies, right? The moment their heart stopped beating, or maybe the moment that they have their last breath. But death is actually a whole event. Everything that happens in the lead up to someone's death, everything that happens after they die, it all contributes to the meaning of the death itself. So when we speak about Jesus' death, we're not just talking about the moment on the cross when he stopped breathing, right? There's everything that happened before, there's everything that happened after. That's all part of Jesus' death event, we might call it, the death event. Is things like, did they have a will when they left it? That makes a difference in thinking about their death. Did you spend a lot of time crying with them? You know, that makes a big difference to the death. That's part of the death event. Did they leave a letter? Did they leave their debts for you to pay off, right? All of this changes how you experience and make meaning out of their death. And similarly, even though we know Jesus is not just another human being, we can see that actually Jesus' full life leading up to his death, and especially in the events that right leading up to his death, from the Passover on, or from him coming into Jerusalem on, they all really give us clues as to what the death means. So I don't know if you've noticed it, but in our scripture readings, we've been actually reading through the death events chronologically in Luke, starting with Luke 22. And we've kind of done a section each time. And today was the trial before Pilate and Herod. So with Jesus, as we've been looking at these events, I think we had the very first week we talked about the Last Supper up in the upper room. And I preached on that a few weeks ago. And there we saw, okay, if we look at this part of the death event, we see that Jesus is talking about the Passover, using the language of Passover, and actually inviting his disciples to see his death as the next exodus, the next sort of like freeing slaves, liberating slaves. But this time it's all people, not just a particular people. Jesus is this new way of liberation. You can be part of God's family, whoever you are. And then David preached the next week on Jesus' arrest in the garden. right, the betrayal, when Simon Peter pulls out a sword and cuts off the ear of the servant. And then Jesus puts the ear back on and says, put away your sword. And that moment we see, oh yeah, violence always damages the weakest. And this moment tells us that the cross is about the power of nonviolence. That's where he's heading. And then last week, Tim preached on the moment when Simon of Cyrene is asked to carry the cross on the way up. And the women behind are wailing, crying loudly to bring attention, like this is unjust what is happening. And here we see that actually the death event is a moment of co-suffering love, just like Simon suffered alongside Jesus. God has solidarity with humanity in our suffering. Right? All these different events leading up. And then today, all these things that happen before and after, they help us to understand the meaning of Jesus' death. And then today we had the story of the trial before Pilate and Herod. And I think one of the meanings that people often find here in the trial is, here's an innocent person being put to death as a substitution for those who are actually guilty. I think that's often what people find in this trial moment. Now, you might remember also from a few weeks back that I mentioned one of the questions that was asked when I was being interviewed to come to Artisan, and it was asked in a, oh, please, I hope not sort of way, was, is she going to preach penal substitutionary atonement, which is this view of the cross, which is Jesus takes the punishment for sin by suffering and dying in our place and bears God's judgment against a guilty humanity. And I think in this trial, this is often where people see this. Here's a really important distinction, though, and I think it's really, really important. And this week, I feel like I've been relearning it and even learning new stuff in it. We have to distinguish between shame and guilt in the cross. Shame and guilt are each found. They are each found in the events leading up to the cross. They're both really strong themes, but they are not the same lens in these death events. The cross is not doing the same thing with guilt that it is doing with shame. I am so convinced of this, and I'm going to try and convince you of this too. The shame piece is one thing, the guilt thing is another. So, next week, I'm going to talk about guilt and forgiveness of sins, but this week, I want to talk about shame, so we get that out of the way. It's an important one, and actually, I think there's a lot in it, but I don't want it to be mixed up with guilt and forgiveness of sins, okay? So today's, I want to look through at the cross through the lens of shame today. And I think, first of all, let's get ourselves on the same page about why I'm making such a big deal about the difference. And I'm going to invite you to just do a little bit of work here, if you're willing, and just talk to the person next to you, or even if they're a stranger, if you don't like strangers, feel free to look like you're writing things down furiously so that nobody talks to you. But just really quickly, say to the person next to you, how do you think shame and guilt are different? And kids, I see there's actually a little circle there, Leo, Theo, Lewin, etc. You guys can do this too. What do you think the difference is between guilt and shame? Okay, go, you got a minute. Okay. I'm sure there's lots more to be said. Lots more to be said, but if we were to pull everything that was just said, we probably would have said everything. So let's just get a few of these things into the center. Call them out. What in your group were you using to distinguish between shame and guilt? And let's see how many things we can kind of pull out of our discussions. Yeah. Okay, yeah, so if we think about the example of a court case, we're deciding whether or not you're guilty, not whether you should be ashamed of yourself. Okay, that's a good example to get us started. Great, thanks, Elias. How do we distinguish? Yeah, Tasha.
Guilt comes from
actions.
Yep. Shame.
Okay, so guilt is more about an action that you do. And shame is maybe something that people put on us. So maybe it may not even be something that comes from inside us. Yeah. There are some studies that show that shame can show up, or the shame affect, like the things that happen in your body when you feel shame, like your flushed face, can happen in infants. So it's potentially something, there's something in the experience of shame that can be very early in us, but often shame comes. It's something to do with outside of us. For sure. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
Talking about feeling that guilt comes from an action, something that you've done, but shame can come from something that you are.
Yeah. So the difference between I have done a bad thing and I am a bad person. Yeah. Shame is I am a bad person. Guilt is I have done a bad thing. Okay. Yeah. Rhonda. Yeah. Guilt is that experience of knowing somehow, and you're connecting it to the work of the Holy Spirit and kind of going, hey, you're not in alignment right now with your own code of ethics. You know, you just did something that actually you don't think is right. Yeah, great. Shauna?
Shame feels really hard to get rid of. Whereas
yeah. Yes. Okay, so guilt, there are things that you can do to shift guilt. You know, like, I'm sorry that I did that. All right, I forgive you. Guilt. Done. Shame is a lot harder. Like, how do you get rid of the feeling that I'm a bad person? Like, how do you get rid of that, right? Actually, a kid that I talked to this week said something similar. Like, guilt is quicker. Shame takes longer to accumulate. Also, it's harder to get rid of. Jenny, you had your hand in the back? Similar.
Yeah.
Okay, and saying it out loud is an interesting thing to say too, right? With guilt, actually sometimes it feels fine to say it out loud. Like, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry I'm late. You know, I feel guilty. This is something I do all the time. I'm sorry I'm late. I'm sorry, Scott, that I didn't get the keynote in time this morning. You know, I feel bad. I can say it out loud. But if I walk into this space and actually I'm feeling internally like I'm really just, I don't like myself, how do I say that to anybody? Like, you can't externalize that very easily. Yeah, Toby. Yeah. Yes. Yes. You can feel shame without being guilty of a single thing. You may feel shame from witnessing someone else's guilt. You may feel shame from actually being connected to somebody else who is being shamed. Right? It's not about guilt. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Say guilt is usually true and shame is always false.
Okay. So there's a kind of theological point that you want to make about shame versus guilt, which is great, which is we can be guilty, and actually we often are. shame you want to reject. Like, that is not true. It's a falsehood, shame. Someone back there, I see people are being voluntold to speak. Guilt is a straightener, shame is a perm. I used guilt this morning. I think. I'm getting that right. Okay, so you get the gist here, right? They're really different things. I was thinking about, we think about what shame is. Shame is, an interruption of a positive moment. You can feel shame. Shame is a moment when you're exposed to people around you as somehow deficient or broken or not as good, inferior, right? It's almost always social, even if the people around you don't know. It has to do with the people around you, what they think of you, where you stand in relation to them, right? So actually the instinct of shame is to isolate and cut off. Put on a mask, cover it up, because you don't want to reach out and try to reconnect and be rejected again. It's way too painful, because actually it's about your core self. It's about who I am. Like, am I lovable? Am I worthy? And if I've been rejected before, I have some shame. I am not going to try again, because if I try again and you reject me again, I'm just coming face to face again with my unworthiness, right? So shame is this like terrible experience of having been rejected, I am now unable to reach out for connection, which is the only thing that's going to solve my shame, right? So it's this self-perpetuating isolation, whereas guilty has this, I can make amends. I remember in grade 6, I was new in a classroom in a very small town. I come from a really big city and I moved into a tiny town, and there were two of us who were new that year. And in the whole school. And the two of us got pulled out by the teacher and accused of stealing the pencil of a classmate purely because we were the new kids. Like, there was nothing else. We were the new ones, she didn't trust us, didn't know us, thought we were probably the ones that stole the pencils. And I remember the flush of shame of, like, I had done nothing wrong. I hadn't stolen the pencils, just for the record. But I was like now grouped in the untrustworthy kids group, and such deep shame. And apparently adolescence is really when people experience the most shame ever in their lives, apart from getting really elderly. So I had so much shame in that moment, no guilt. Another time I remember pocketing a toy on my way out of a friend's house, and we lived in a different country, so it was never going back. And I had no shame, but I did feel guilty. And I had a hard time playing with that toy when I got back home. So shame and guilt, they can exist in different spaces, but sometimes we actually mistake shame for guilt, or guilt for shame, right? We can also do that. Like, I talk as if I'm feeling really guilty about something. I know it's not actually a bad thing that I did. I just feel shameful about myself. So I'm feeling the need to talk about my guilt, you know? Okay, so when I think about people's nervousness around the cross as the place where sin is forgiven, it seems to me that one of the issues that we begin is that we begin with the idea of shame. That we are bad at our core, and that our existence is somehow shameful, and that who I am is broken. Who I am is broken. Who I am, my core self, has to be punished for being. Because God can't stand evil, God can't even be in relationship with me without some sort of punishment. And then God punishes someone else who can take the punishment in order to be able to look at me again in love, right? God can't even look at me in love. I'm so broken until God has punished someone for it, right? And you see how we're talking here about shame, not guilt? So next week I want to talk about guilt, forgiveness of sins. But today, let's talk about shame. And let's see what Jesus does with shame on the cross, because I think it's totally different. And I think it's a really core theme in the death events of Jesus. Shame is the lens for Jesus' death. Okay, let me give you another moment to talk to the people around you. Where do you see shame showing up? You can also go back into Jesus' life if you want, but specifically in the sort of lead up to Jesus' death, where do you see moments of shame showing up? If shame is this sort of exposure of vulnerability or exposure of brokenness, weakness, deficiency, that's sort of like social rejection because who you are is somehow less, where do you see that showing up in the death event of Jesus? I'll give you a minute to just talk about that with each other. Okay, sorry, that one was really short, but let's just try to get us to think about it and get into it. Did anybody come up with something from sort of earlier on in Jesus' life before the death events? Did anybody talk about the earlier life of Jesus? No? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. When people are shaming Jesus for saying, you know, like you're taking more honor than you deserve. Blasphemy, saying that you are the Son of God. Blasphemy. And the blasphemy is around taking too much honor. Like you, and the attempt is to shame. Yeah, you need to be brought down a few pegs because you're trying to be someone you're not. Yeah. Yeah, Kathy? I thought you had your hand up. What's that? Oh, excellent. Okay. Do you want to say something as well? Or yeah. I won't do that to everybody. If you scratch your head and I call on you, I won't do that to you. Okay, just Kathy. All right, so we've got really early on these sort of like moments where Jesus is trying to be someone or saying something, and people are like, you're trying to be someone you're not. We gotta bring you back down. What about in the death events? Where do you see shame showing up? Yeah.
The whole system of punishment meant to evoke shame.
Yeah. Yeah. This particular kind of death that's the whole point of it, is to shame. There's a public nature to it, that you're meant to be walked through the streets carrying your shame. You're flogged, you're spat on, you're whipped. Yeah. Your clothes are taken off, right? Yeah, Paul. Yeah. Yeah, and so there's a few different things like that. Like in the story that we're going to talk about today is like putting on a pretend king, like costume. Like you're a king, okay, we'll put this crown of thorns on your head. We'll put this fancy robe on you, making fun of him, yeah. And then also on the cross, right, there's this sign that says King of the Jews. It's meant to also be a mockery, yeah. Okay, I think that it starts all the way back at the Last Supper, at least. Up in the upper room, Luke 22:24, when the disciples are arguing about who's the greatest. Do you remember that? So they're all sitting around this Last Supper, and Jesus says, you know, he says, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. Those in authority over them are called benefactors, but not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, the leader, like the one who serves. And I am among you as one who serves, or in other versions, like the Son of Man has come to serve, not to be served, right? And here, actually, culturally, what he's doing is taking on shame, right? The person who is the lowest in the room is the one who washes feet, and he's saying, I'm going to wash your feet. So he's coming down in underneath at the lowest point. The person who would have shame in the room, he's just displaced them, moved them up a notch, right? And being the one who takes on the lowest shame. So right away from this moment, as he's starting to prepare his disciples, he's saying, this journey is not about honor. This journey is actually about moving down, not moving up. And you're going to have a hard time with it. He says, you're going to have a hard time with it. He says, you're going to betray me. You're going to have a hard time sticking with me through this. Like, it's going to actually feel like shame. And I'm going to be doing this. Like, come with me, but prepare yourselves. And then he's arrested in the garden, and it's at night, because he actually has too much social honor to be arrested during the daytime. But once he's arrested, some of that is taken away, right? He's being beaten, he's being whipped, he's had his clothes taken off. Like, physically, in the daytime now, he will look shamed, right? So there's a arrest him at night when people aren't around. He spat on, these ways of shaming him, putting him in his place, right? And I think the words that Jesus spoke to his disciples, he's trying to prepare them to say, I'm ready to suffer this shame, and I know it's coming. Come with me. And then we get here to the trial. So he's going before Pilate and then Herod. Well, first before the religious leaders, then Pilate, and then Herod. And they're trying to accuse him of claiming more honor than he should. But Jesus, do you notice this? Just refuses to play the game. It's fascinating watching. I mean, if I was there, it would have been so painful, right? But looking back at the narrative, you're just in awe of Jesus. Jesus, you know, this incredible exchange. The teachers of the law try to shame him. So you're the Messiah. Like, you think you're the Messiah, like, literally, that you're the person that we've all been waiting for centuries. You're that person. And he says, well, if I tell you I am, you're not going to believe me. And if I were to ask you what you think, you wouldn't tell me. So what's the game here? Well, I'm not going to play the game. But the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. Oh, so you're the Son of God, they say. Oh, okay. But he's untrickable, right? He's just sticks to what he is, who he is. He says, well, you said it, not me. I'm like, after he has received such shame, I cannot imagine myself being in a position of having been shamed publicly like this, and have the wherewithal to respond in this way to people who have the power to kill me. Okay, so they take him to Pilate, and they say, hey, this guy says he's a king, even though he deliberately didn't say that. And Pilate says, so are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus, again, will not be shamed. He says, well, you've said so. And Pilate's like, well, I can't really see a problem with this guy. He's not actually claiming more honor, and he looks pretty humiliated right now, so Jesus sends him, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to humiliate Herod because I don't like that guy. I'm going to send him over to Herod, and Herod can deal with him. And Herod thinks, ooh, I get a free magic show. That's the idea, right? But again, Jesus just does not play the game. He doesn't answer the questions. They're mocking him. They're making fun of him. They dress him up in a costume like a king, and he just refuses to take the shame. He refuses. It says in verse 12, this is just such a profound line, that Pilate and Herod became friends that day. They had been enemies before. Shaming another person can do that, right? It makes enemies into friends, because now you both stand above that person. We see each other. Oh, yeah, we're the ones above in this situation, shaming Jesus. We've got someone even weaker now that we can pick on. Pilate wants to release him, but the crowd just keeps insisting that he be crucified. And again, like we just mentioned, this is actually, Spencer said, this is, they're shaming him. They're saying he deserves shame. The crucifixion is that kind of a death. You've probably heard it said, right, that it was a shameful, most shameful death possible, but one of the markers for me of that is, did you know that Roman citizens weren't ever crucified? And the reason they were not crucified was because to crucify a Roman person or a Roman citizen would be to bring shame on the Roman Empire, right? You don't have a representative shamed like that, you'll shame the whole. So same thing here, cross is a punishment that's reserved for people who are considered subhuman, enslaved people, criminals without family, that kind of thing. And here they put this crown of thorns on Jesus' head to shame him for speaking about a new kingdom. They put a sign above his head that says, "This is the King of the Jews." They're trying to shame not just Jesus, but all the Jewish people, all the people who have followed Jesus. This is because in this century in Palestine, shame was contagious. And I think we can imagine a little bit of it today. You know, maybe a friend or a parent or a spouse gets shamed somehow. Or if you're the first woman to do something, first person of color to be in a particular role, you're the youngest person to ever be elected into such and such, you feel like you carry the shame and the honor of all the people like you. You're like, if I fail at this, I will bring shame to all other women, people of color, etc. Right? So we have a bit of that in our culture. You may feel like you have to succeed so you don't bring shame on those you represent. And here, there's a real attempt to not just shame Jesus, but those that Jesus represents. So all through this story, I think it's so clear Jesus is the target of shame. Jesus is the target of shame. But what I hope you've seen also, what I find so fascinating is as the story progresses, we see Jesus just refuse to play the game of shame and transform the shame actually into honor and glory. Like just declares it, you know, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of God. He's experiencing the most extreme human shame, and it's impossible to shame him. Total powerlessness, humiliation, even at a spiritual level, like cosmic powers. And if you've had that feeling of like something I'm trying to do that I thought was of God has failed, and does that mean that I was wrong about that? It's happening here, right? Like his disciples are going, oh, shoot, we were wrong about it. He was a fraud. Makes you think of John 5:39, where Jesus says to his disciples, "I do not receive my glory or my honor from people. It doesn't come from people." It's actually impossible to shame this guy for claiming more honor than he deserves because he is not trying to move up. He's trying to move down. Rather, he's already at the bottom. There is no shame to take away. And his honor is not the type that can be taken away by human beings, because at every point in his life, he is being filled up with honor through the Spirit and from God, through his relationship with the Father. Philippians 2, where it talks about he did not see equality with God something to be grasped after, but emptied himself, right? Like a jug of water, emptied it all out. There's nothing left to empty out. How can you take honor out of a person who has already given it all away? How can you shame someone by exposing them if what is inside is divinely appointed honor? How can someone lose at a game they're not even playing? The phrase that I've had rolling around in my head this week is actually from Hebrews 12, 2. "For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." That phrase I just really has been embedding in me. For the joy set before him, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. It's not like this is a big, wonderful plan. This is like the evil that is shameful. The cross is shameful. but scorning that shame, sat down at the right hand of God. Jesus is so connected to the Father's love, so sure of the joy of the kingdom, so right within himself, so sure of his calling, that he can scorn the shame of the cross. Scorn is what usually causes shame, right? But it's this, like, scorning the shame itself and showing up the act to actually be shameful rather than himself. When I consider what it means to take up the cross or to follow Jesus to the cross, I think this lens of shame is really powerful. Take up the cross is to refuse to be embarrassed by the embarrassment of standing with those who have been shamed. And to take up the cross is to scorn the shame of a bully on a playground, right? It's to remember that God doesn't just forgive sins, but that God actually forgets that that was even a part of us. Because what God sees in us, in our core self, is our original goodness. That image of God that is in us, that belovedness. You know, Hebrews 10:17, God's promise that I will remember their sins no more. I will remember it no more. It's just not even there. When I look at you, I do not see it. I don't see it. It's gone. You know, imagine going to a person that you've actually felt shamed before and them just saying, oh, I didn't even remember that that happened. Right? And they're like, oh, so you haven't been seeing me this way all that time? It's the same thing here with Jesus. It's just like, I don't even remember it. I don't play the game. I don't play the game of shame. It's just not even in my repertoire. I think the question is, how do we do this? Like, how do we set down shame? How do we have such a strong sense of the joy? And like we were mentioning earlier, one of the instincts of shame is to isolate and to disconnect because we're afraid of rejection. And I think in the very first place, there's an offer in the cross of connection, right? Of like, come, come to the Father, come to the Spirit. You won't be rejected. There's no rejection here. You don't have to be afraid of being exposed. Everything in you is already seen. And what I see is divine belovedness. I know it's harder than that. I'm just an invitation to lean into that. These quotes about shame and how to repair shame are a bit wordy, so I don't know if they're going to be helpful, but shame requires an intervention that involves getting rid of the perception of the inferior self, the restoration of dignity or self-worth, the repair of broken attachment bonds. That is the cross, when I think about it. That is the cross, the restoration of dignity. There's no inferior self, like God's already displaced the bottom rung. And getting rid of shame requires reattachment, the promise of return, and interest. This is fascinating. When you feel shamed, you can't be interested in the people around you because you are so worried about yourself. And Jesus, because he does not take on shame, can remain fully interested in the whole world. So there's an invitation for us to do that too. Not to go to that inward place of shame that, like, this is literally what shame does to you physically in the flesh, but to actually be like, there's no shame there. I can maintain my interest in the world, my care for the world, my connection. I think our big and our little shames that are accumulated over a lifetime of feeling exposed or deficient or broken, worthless, rejected, we're invited to scorn that and to set our eyes on the joy of the kingdom, the joy of our belovedness, the joy of restoration, to scorn that shame. How can someone take your honor if God is the one who gives it? How can you lose a game if you're not playing it? What would it look like for you to quit the game of shame and honor? What would it look like for you to be crucified and raised to new life with Jesus? And you feel the possibility that actually there might be a lot of joy in that, not just sacrifice. Like the smirk you can't wipe off your teenager's face. Or the the wartime dancing videos that we see coming out, right? Irrepressible life, shamelessness in following Jesus. I pray for that for us. Let me pray for that for us, and then we'll come to the table. God, we thank you. We thank you for Jesus, and we thank you for Jesus's death and resurrection and everything leading up to it. And we thank you for this encouragement, this empowerment, this example, this pioneer of faith that goes before us in moving downward and in scorning any shame that might be accumulating in us. We ask for the strength and the joy that can help to displace that, for the courage to move towards repair, and to be able to see ourselves the way you do. In Jesus' name, amen.